නමෝ තස්ස භගවතෝ අරහතෝ සම්මා සම්බුද්දස්ස නමෝ තස්ස භගවතෝ අරහතෝ සම්මා සම්බුද්දස්ස නමෝ තස්ස භගවතෝ අරහතෝ සම්මා සම්බුද්දස්ස බුද්ධං ධම්මං සංඝං නමස්සාමි. So, 24 hours, long or short, if it's painful it's long, if you get blissed out it's short. I teach a beginner's class in meditation at Ottawa U, which is interesting, four sessions in 4 weeks. And a few semesters. I tell people about these retreats, and I can't believe we're doing this. And no food in the afternoon, no talking, no blackberry. How many hours do you sit? They're really quite short. So it is an extraordinary undertaking to do this. Very, very few people would be inclined this way. I'm for mad or what. But I think the only thing, the way you can do it is if you're an enthusiast. So that's why I see it as a hobby. I really do. I was saying to Keith, I said, you know, I get this great food, people spoil me rotten, and I can talk about my hobby. So if you think about a hobby, right, you know, you're doing some weaving or some woodwork or cooking or whatever, and you've got some difficult thing that you know, you're interested in making. Why are you interested? Because it is difficult. You know, like in hobby, if you do some weaving and you sort that one out, you don't want to go into production, right, and do it again and again and again. So you're like, wow, try this, try that. So there's a kind of interest with the complexity. And you see someone else looks at it, why would you want to do that? Why do you spend all your time doing that? It's complex. And I think that attitude of being like interested in meditation and curious and trying stuff out, I think that really works. It does work. Whereas the attitude of kind of just, you know, grit your teeth there, eventually you get enlightened. If I sit here long enough, my head will blow open. Or the other way, make no effort. It's all, you know, I'm enlightened already. So sometimes we get like too passive, sometimes we get too serious. But we do have like capacity to develop skills. So in the text, the Buddha is often giving analogies of meditation to a musician who's tuning an instrument, Fletcher who's making an arrow nice and straight, carpenter who's working a piece of wood, and those are the images of craft. Okay. So if there's that attitude, trying, you know, then you do try stuff out, don't you? You get an intuition about your own character, what works. You just touch on something. And that, again, that's the way of learning. You know, if you think about a child, and the child's trying to do something, and you just overbearingly tell the child how to do it all the time. And the child gets ticked off. We all do. If you're trying to learn something, and the instructor just keeps telling you how to do it, you can leave me alone. I'll figure it out. So too much instruction, I think, and too rigid a technique, I don't think really works. It doesn't work for me, at least. So in the text you find like general suggestions around effort, and suggestions around breathing and so on and so forth. But the learning comes from that quality of inquiry, of watching cause and effect, of trying stuff out, and then learning that way. And that takes what do they say about a skill? I think 10,000 hours, right? I think that's the number I've read. 10,000 hours. So that's, if I do 15 minutes a day, it's going to take a long time. So if I can update a bit. And so now, like, we have this chance to try to hone our skills, and all of us face different kinds of challenges. There's one question which I think I'd like to just speak to in terms of the general approach Buddhism has to life. So, your thoughts on how do we combine the need not to harm anyone and the need to take actions in a work context or others, such as taking disciplinary measures or rigorous follow-up, knowing this will not please the individual and may sadden him or her. And it's always important to remember that the Buddha taught both a social dharma and an inner dharma. So one is called conventional truth, and one is called liberating truth. And in conventional truth, he didn't really spell it out in detail like a Koran for the laity. He spelled out some general principles. He certainly spelled it out for the monks and nuns, how they should live together according to social principles. And these are rules. These are rules that we live by. It's called the Vinaya. So when the Buddha was in his last year, he was asked, so the text is short, he was asked who you leave as your heir, and he said, I don't leave a person, I leave you the Dhamma and the Vinaya. So the Dhamma is the teaching that he offered, and the Vinaya is the principles and standards and rules and etiquettes and so on and so forth of the monastic order, because the question is coming from monastics. And if you translate that into lay life, Vinaya for lay life is his precepts. But it's more than that. It's like what the work situation asks of you. So if you're working for government, there are certain rules that government employees live by. And those are common agreements. And the more clear those agreements are made, the better it is. So if someone, say in a monastery, goes against our conventions and etiquettes, our duty is to admonish them. It's a duty to admonish a monk. And when a monk becomes so hopeless, this is interesting, so hopeless, we say he's alachi, and alachi means shameless. He's got no more remorse, right? Then the order no longer offers him admonishment. He's no longer worthy of admonishment. Interesting, huh? You can't really fire a monk. In Thailand, you can't. You can disrobe them. The civil authorities have. Anyway, that's Thai legal system. But it's interesting that admonishment is actually very important in the training of a monk or a nun. And being able to offer admonishment is the duty of the other monks. And especially the teacher. Teacher's duty is to train, offer admonishment. But in the offering admonishment, the Buddha says the person who is giving the admonishment has to be very clear in their own conscience. Are they pure in this action themselves? Do they understand the rules? Do they understand the consequences of breaking the rules? Do they understand the Vinaya? Are they pure? Are they living by that rule themselves? Is the intention in their heart one of kindness and helping this person to grow in the Dhamma? So there's kind of inner recollection for the person who's offering the admonishment. And then for the person who is receiving the admonition, also there's a recollection of does the person get defensive? Do they accuse the other of doing the same? Are they willing to listen? So you'll find that I think Venerable Ananda gets admonished in the first council, and he doesn't really agree with it, but he says, okay, we'll take that on board. So there's a whole, there's a lot of teaching for monastics around admonishment. Now, when it comes to lay life, the Buddha couldn't prescribe all these things, because each lay person, each village, each community, each company and work situation is different. But what he did what he did recommend is a mutuality of respect and responsibility. So an employee has a responsibility to the employer. The employer has responsibility to the employee, mutually respectful, mutually responsible. Husband to wife, wife to husband. Teacher to student, student to teacher, which is one way. And so on and so forth. Father to son, son to father to daughter, parent to child to parent. And that's quite, it's quite beautiful, and obviously it has to be that way. It has to be a kind of mutuality of respect. And these are voluntary things. This is all like the Vinaya that we live by is voluntary. It's not really, there's no kind of police force watching us. We work that way. So in a work situation, when a person gets a wage and they get benefits and all of that, they don't get those benefits for nothing. Right? They have to work according to the principles of a work situation, and they have to produce according. So when you sign the contract and you go into that work situation, there's a sort of a accepted norm of behavior. And sometimes that's not so clear. Sometimes the work situation is not very fair, etc., etc. But anyway, then given that, the duty of someone in a senior position is to admonish and to criticize, you know, to help this person to be in that work situation in a better and better way. And that's not a lack of kindness. That's just the way it is. And if someone is so alachi, so shameless, and they get fired, they do that to themselves. Right? They create a kind of karmic situation of hurting themselves because they're not living according to the standards. Now that's idealized. I realize that work situations there can be abusive bosses and, you know, there's all kinds of nasty things that go on. But from that question, it's very important to remember that the worldly dharmas, you know, are ones where admonishing is fine. Because otherwise you couldn't live life. Criticism is fine. Firing someone is fine. And it's just the way it is. If someone is being really just lazy and unproductive and foolish in their work behavior, then they've earned the pink slip or whatever color that slip is. Whatever slip. Anyway, that's just in the nature of things. It has to be that way. How could it be any other way? It has to be that way. And that's not cruel, isn't it? But the intent is not to hurt. It's not to hurt. It's just that's the contract. That's the social contract. You have to have that. So in the Vinaya, you find the Buddha, a monk So the Buddha allowed certain things in the evening as kind of tonics for the monks and nuns. So he allowed honey. Yay. So we're allowed to have honey in the evening. So one monk, he starts to hoard honey. You know, and all the other monks start joking about him because there's honey dripping off the rafters. Bottles and bottles of honey around. And then finally the Buddha hears about it and calls him. Is this true? Yes, Bhakti. He's this foolish man. I teach for dispassion, not passion. I teach for renunciation, not accumulation. What are you doing? And he sets up a law. He sets up a rule. And the Buddha, you know, he's really lays into some of these characters. I mean, when you read the suttas, you never see that part of the life of the Sangha, but boy, he really cracks into some people. He's just like really fierce language. And you can see why he's doing that, because he's doing that because this person is like just so lost the plot. And he's a good kick in the backside. But it comes from a really strong and clear place. It doesn't come from aversion. It doesn't come from a mind which doesn't understand. So, you know, why I'm portraying it that way is because sometimes the practices of the heart can sound so impractical or sentimental or weak even. So, you know, if you're a Buddhist, you have to be a doormat kind of thing. But there can be strength. And Ajahn Chah can be very, very strong. You know, you didn't muck about that man. just knew, you know, you start lying to him, and he's gonna have your number. And yet, you always sense this tremendous compassion, this tremendous love from him. It's really, really neat to see this kind of this power, but this deep compassion. So not to see compassion as being a weakness, or but usually where we don't want to admonish just because of fear, our own fears of not being liked or whatever. Or maybe we've blown it, you know, we've criticized someone from our own anger. And then that's been very, very messy. So it's a difficult one, Matt. And so you check your own heart. But if you're in a position of responsibility and authority and you're managing something, then that's just part of your contract. Because as a senior monk, if someone is not fulfilling the kind of social contract we have as a monastery, and I'm just allowing that, I'm affecting all the other monks. So I have a duty and responsibility to them, not just to this individual. So it's something bigger than me. So this work world isn't probably so straightforward, either as monasticism, but to not see like the practices of kindness as being just kind of weak. And so when a person is not functioning correctly, they need admonishment if they're going to stay in the game. If they don't get that admonishment, one day they get blindsided and they're out. No one's told them. And that's even more cruel, isn't it? You know, so the person doesn't see what they're doing and then they're told to leave. So with admonishment, you try to really if you have to admonish, you look at your own heart and realize your intention is not to harm. So that later on, the person blames you. Oh, you were just angry. Well, no, my intention wasn't that. It wasn't to harm. It was just appropriate to time and place. And if one is being admonished, then to look at the tendency, say, well, I saw you do something just like that last week. Or getting defensive and completely agreeing, yes, you're absolutely right, I'm hopeless, or, you know, whatever posture we take, to listen to that as we're being admonished is very, very interesting to see, isn't it? Where the sense of self arises with praise and blame. Very interesting to see. So that's called the social truth, or samuti satya, or conventional truth. And vimutti is liberation, vimutti satya, is about stream of consciousness. And that's where within our social activity we also observe the way things are in stream of consciousness. And we're trying to do both. So not only am I required to admonish someone at work maybe, but I'm also watching my fear or my doubt or my anger or my irritation and seeing that and understanding that in the context of the Four Noble Truths, suffering and the abandonment of suffering. So it's very important to remember there's both going on. And on, like when I teach, I'm talking about stream of consciousness, I really talk about social conventions. So I'm just talking about how you use it about meditation or how you work with the mind. So say something like kindness, developing kindness is I think one of the lovely things about this path is that which works for you works for others. And the fact that by practicing forgiveness, practicing gratitude, I liberate my heart from a lot of mean-minded kind of tendencies is good for me and it's good for you. So like I've been saying the last few weeks in the various meetings I've been to, say, compassion is the method. Kindness is the method. Forgiveness is the method. It's a method which liberates my heart, but also makes me a much more clearly functional person in ordinary life. It's really quite, even though it can sound selfish, like we're always meditating and, you know, working on ourselves, when you think about the consequences of it, it's a no-log. It's not at all, is it? But I've just been noticing this retreat. I haven't had one bit of anxiety. And I'm really proud of myself. You know, I usually talk about my bad qualities, right? But lately I said, well, actually I'm doing pretty good. And I, just to you know, to encourage you, is that I used to be so afraid on these retreats. You know, I'd have to go to the toilet 5 times before coming down here. And it's gone. What is it? It's not there. Now, what is that? It's not me. You know, I'm not sitting here not being afraid. It's just that fear hasn't been fed anymore. It hasn't been given fuel anymore. And so that's one of the important things in this practice of Dhamma, in this hobby of liberation, is that it's a tough hobby. it ain't easy to sit through some of the stuff that we sit through. And so there is this idea of purification, that we, for whatever reason, and this kind of speaks to a question here. Let me go read a question up first to just address that. In our guided meditations, you often speak of becoming aware of the thoughts, conditions, or moods of the mind and making them objects of our meditation as opposed to subjects. As objects, we need not attach to them. I find that thoughts or moods are typically easier to objectify. They have a discrete quality to them, a beginning and an end. Question. Conditions in my mind, on the other hand, I'm not sure what the person means by conditions, particularly if they stem from repetitive negative learning in childhood, for example, have a different quality to them. They are harder to objectify in meditation. They feel entrenched, continue a spiral with no beginning, no end. So the question, is there special instruction or any guidance that would help with these deeper conditions? So that takes me to this idea of purification, that all of us are conditioned from childhood. So we all have patterns of behavior which we've not probably understood rationally. They just arise with our families or in social situations. That's how an ego is built up, isn't it? Personality is built up of skill and lack of skill. And so we try to be as conscious as possible of how that all works. And let's say someone who was severely abused as a child, it's very hard to be conscious of things because they're so hidden. You know, they're so hidden away as a protective means, as a means of survival. So that person might only experience some of the upheavals of that conditioning in a conscious way maybe 40 years into their life. You know, maybe the first 40 years they're just functioning with anger and fear and so on, but not really conscious of it. And then maybe that would come up much, much later. That's an extreme. Or maybe that, as it became conscious, the person would see there's something amiss here, and then they go to the therapist. So some things like Buddhist, this practice of awareness, it would be very hard to look at it. You need help. You need someone who could help you make it conscious. It could help this person become conscious of that. So Buddhist practice of mindfulness doesn't work in all situations. Things which are very hidden, things which are painful. So if someone is coming back from Afghanistan and they're suffering some kind of post-traumatic stress, I mean, those whew, difficult stuff, and they need a lot of help, a lot of skilled training to get the person to be with this. And the process would still be the same, and that would be the process of purification. Because when things become conscious, they as they become conscious, they come into view. Right? If they're not conscious, you can't really work with them. Someone else might see, oh, this person's quite fearful. But the person is fearful, they're not conscious yet. So how do we make things conscious? Well, people help us, or we just become more aware of what's going on. So this the idea of purification is when things become conscious, we begin to know them as both bodily sensation, we begin to see the storylines, we begin to see the reactions. We have some kind of objective awareness, even just a little bit. And that's the beginning of freedom. Because once I can be objective to something, then I'm no longer the subject. I'm now the witness. And in that witnessing, I no longer give energy to this. And so the word attachment in Upadana in Buddhism, the word attachment means both clinging to something, grasping it through ignorance, but also fueling it. It has this double meaning, and it makes a lot of sense. If I'm sitting here and I get irritated at someone outside making noise, that the arising of that irritation comes because it's a part of the mental habits of my mind. When I don't like something, I get irritated and angry, say. So that's the habitual pattern that comes up. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's just the way it is, because that's the mind's been conditioned. But when it arises, if I'm aware of it, then, and I witness to it, then I begin to see it as an object. It still feels uncomfortable and unpleasant, but I use skill not to follow the storyline, not to get rid of it, but just to be with it, to hold it in consciousness, to have compassion for it, all these kinds of ideas. Then I'm no longer attached to it, plus I'm not fueling it. Huh? And because I'm not fueling it, that fuel begins to cease. It might take a long, long time. So like with me, with like giving talks and fear, many, many, many years of just being quite frightened and quite loose bowels. it's hard for me to describe that, but the fact that, say, I would come to a sitting or a talk and I would just be with a fear. And I saw that's what's important. It's not what I say. It's just being aware of the fear. So then there's the witnessing of the fear. There's a desire to run away. The desire to say, you give the talk. Or then I'd rehearse, right? And I'd get a list. And then I go blank. And all kinds of strategies, anything but the fear. And I feel first this way. And then learning about it, feeling it in the guts, seeing the mind go, feeling the body tremble, feeling the lips tremble, the whole nine yards. And this is who it is now. And just that sense of awareness, and slowly, compassion, kindness, bringing that up, doing all those practices, slowly begins to see. So, non-attachment, non-fueling. Now, if I mistake, then some people mistake non-attachment as never having any emotional upsurge. It's ridiculous. That's not non-attachment. That's just a viewpoint of repression. Right? I mean, that's just not how the mind works. So non-attachment does not mean non-feeling. It just means the knowing of feeling is feeling. That's different. Attachment is always with a strong sense of self or denial or whatever is operating, trying to get rid of it, not really knowing it. So in fact, non-attachment is full feeling, fully feeling something, fully knowing in the body, fully accepting it. And that's what practices of compassion and kindness and welcoming are very important. And that's why knowing thoughts are important, because the indulgence in thoughts is a form of attachment. So there's non-fueling. So getting to this question, when the person says, I find that thoughts or moods are particularly easy to objectify, well, anything that is a condition is also a mood. It's not like, just because they don't recognize a mood doesn't mean it's not a mood. So a mood in the Buddhist sense is any mind state. So I think what happens typically is that initially we're aware of ourselves at a more superficial level, both physically and emotionally. And then as we practice awareness, I do think we kind of get to more and more layers of things. Things are revealed to us. And then that process can be helped through therapy, I think, I suppose. I've never done therapy, but especially people who are have had a really terrible, terrible childhood, they really need that kind of help, and that's very skillful. But once something is conscious, then, you know, I don't think you don't really need to do that much about it, except to be aware of it, be patient with it, have kindness towards it, love towards it. And then the more we do that with just superficial things, the more our awareness becomes more intuitive, more continuous, and more, it has more depth. It has more depth. And so we continually go to the sense of discontent we might feel. So sometimes we don't know maybe what the source of the discontent is, but we know it's not right. There's some imbalance, there's some sense of lack, or, you know, it does feel off in some way. And that's symptomatic of where we have to go. We have to understand suffering. We have to stand under it. We have to allow it to become conscious, basically. That's what we're doing when we say, in the First Noble Truth, there is suffering, and the suffering has been understood. But the suffering has to be understood. The suffering has been understood. It's the way the Buddha phrases it. So to understand suffering, you have to stand under it. You have to make it conscious. So any sense of lack or being off or some way, you say, what is that? You become more and more conscious. And as you become conscious of it, you have a chance to be aware of it and understand it. But certainly some habits of self-referral, like self-definition, seem so real. You know, some modes of self-criticism can seem like just so, or self-doubt can seem so very, very real, that they don't seem like moods. They just seem like reality. And yet it's still a thought, it's still a mood of the mind, you know, it's still a movement which arises and ceases according to causes and conditions. So, to understand ourselves, what's very, very good is to do samadhi practice. So samadhi practice is the capacity to use the breath, to use space, to use metta or whatever, to bring the mind to a sense of balance and clarity. And then that balance and clarity creates a contrast to contraction, lack, self-doubt, whatever it is, you create a contrast. So if I've done, so like with fear, I did a lot of metta practice, and really kind of trying to kind of get, as thought, I tried to do metta practice as heart, to really bring out a feeling of heart. And then I began to see, as I touched the open heart, it created a contract to the contraction of the heart, which fear is doing. I get more and more aware of my belly, so body awareness is very helpful. So just really get immersed in the body and make the body, let it become feeling, tune into the body. So then, as I had more and more understanding of the body and the belly and the heart, belly and the heart, I began to see how what fear did there. So then I could be more and more aware of fear as a bodily sensation. And so contrast is helpful. Contrast. If I calm the mind, when my mind is becoming uncalm in some way, but if I've got no contrast, if I'm just running around, you know, chasing a whole list of things I have to do, then there's no samadhi. There's no clarity. And because there's no clarity, there's no contrast. And because there's no contrast, it's just spinning around. So that's meditation, one of the many things in meditation practice. In helping us bring that kind of clarity. So meditation practice is developing all kinds of skillful things, not just a pleasant meditation every now and then, but developing the capacity to stay with the way things are. So kind of an investigating capacity, the capacity to be patient with like discomfort. Because things which are hidden and not very conscious, they're very uncomfortable. We don't want to look at them. We don't want to be with them. Need a distraction, that can be so quick. So meditation practices are really kind of laying a foundation for deeper and deeper insight. So the teachers and therapists and others can help us maybe become more conscious, but I think this process does work. It just takes, you know, some things are just more hidden than others. But one of my friends used to say, he says, his capacity for suffering is always 100%. The others is always full on anyway. So you always got something to work with, some, you know, some whatever's going on. I mean, keep going to that. Where's the mind tight? Where's the heart contracted? Keep learning how to let go of that. And the rest opens up. So you know, keep in mind, consider the difference between like just falling into a mood and purification, say. Okay, so let's say I'm feeling like it's a gray day in the end of November, say, and the snow hasn't come yet, and it's raining, and my arthritis is acting up, and I start to feel a bit damp. And then my mind is coming, and I don't ski, and I don't skate, and we just come, no. The mind just goes in, and that's just indulging in thought, isn't it? That's just a bad habit. But take something gets triggered in you through, you get really, blindsided by something, you get this rage coming out of you. These are extreme examples. That rage is not an indulgence. That's just the kind of karmic momentum of some huge disappointment. There you just have to bear with it. You have to witness it, right? So once sometimes you can lift your mind out of a mood, I'm not going there. I'm not touching that. I've been there too often. And it's not repression, it's just clarity. Other times you just have to wait it out. It's just so powerful to wait it out. And variations on that. So there's no fixed method around this, but the important thing is to know your intention. Is your intention to really allow this to be the way it is and then to experiment with it or trying to get rid of it? What's going on? What's happening? And that's the skill of the carpenter or the musician, whatever. Bear with me, I'll be done soon. Can the attachment to the khandhas be used to contemplate bodily feeling? I don't understand that. To contemplate bodily feeling, can attachment, I don't understand this question at all. Can the attachment to the khandhas be used to contemplate bodily feeling? Well, if you're attached to the khandhas, you're not contemplating. Right? The khandhas are a way of talking our mind-body experience. And attachment is just not it's being heedless. So, noticing, could someone answer this, write this again for me next, for tomorrow? I quite understand. So attachment means heedlessness, okay? So like bodily feelings are painful or pleasant or whatever, and then I'm just reacting to it. So, why is the bell going to ring? And if it wasn't here, or wow, is that listening? That's attachment. Contemplation is, this is bliss. This is pain. Who's this one? Contemplation is the objective knowing of things as change. That's what contemplation is. So I'm not sure. Anyway, keep going here. This is a question about. This is after or when noticing a thought and bringing it to awareness, this is the object of mind. How do I know if I'm aggressively rejecting or just gently letting go? Was I compassionate or heartfelt or not? That's a typical question. It's just doubt. It's got nothing to do with letting go. It's attaching to doubt. So quite often this comes up, well, am I really letting go or am I repressing? Well, actually, you're doubting. I'm not being facetious. The mind will do that, right? Because you can't know what you let go 5 minutes ago. You can only know then. But you can know right now that you don't know. You're not sure. Am I doing this right or not? That's a doubt. And doubt is it can seem like a really important question. And you can spin your mind around in these kinds of doubts. Am I repressing? Or am I letting go? What am I doing? Huh? Doubting. Huh? And so doubt is one of those moods of the mind. It is a mood of the mind which can keep you thinking for a long, long time. And to actually know doubt is doubt. This is not being sure. Is the liberation from intellect. The intellect likes an answer. So when a doubt comes up, well, I should have an answer. If that comes up, am I letting go? Am I repressing? So maybe I'll say, are you repressing? Oh, Bhakti says I'm repressing. Okay. Maybe he's not. Maybe I'm letting go. I'm not really sure. Can I go? And you don't see that the problem is the doubt. Right? The problem is the doubt. Because why? Because when we have a doubt, it's uncomfortable, and desire mind wants an answer. Now, doubt is okay. There's nothing wrong with doubt. You know, something burning, is there a fire? Good doubt. Check it out. Right? So there's nothing wrong with doubt. But as a meditator, as contemplative, you can see how the mind can get trapped into that kind of doubtful thinking. And so one of the in the teachings around the hindrances to concentration, one of the five is doubt. And in this sense, it's like, am I getting anywhere with this? Or maybe I should try the other one. Breath, belly, nose, metta. The mind just never settles because it doesn't know. So if you can, like Ajahn Sumedho, he said the biggest hindrance in his meditation practice was doubt. He's got a really strong intellect. So he would just fill his mind with doubt. He'd actually take doubt, just fill it. I don't know what I'm doing. What am I doing? And just kind of fill the mind with doubt. And then feel that kind of uncomfortable sense of not knowing. Who am I? because he identified it. He identified the doubt, then he made it conscious. Deliberately. So it's much more subtle than like anger. You know, anger, wow, it's great, it's got some juice in it. Whereas doubt, it's really just so weird. And basically it's the attachment to the security of the know, having an answer. And again, I'm not, it's not saying that we shouldn't doubt or we shouldn't question, no. But just in terms of cultivating stillness, that will be one of the hindrances that might come up. So if you have a question like this about, am I being too aggressive or am I compassionate, then whatever you define aggression as, be aggressive, see what happens. And then be compassionate, see what happens. What is compassion? What is aggression? Right? So then you'll take that doubt and then you'll just apply it and see what happens. Then you can use doubt very skillfully. What happens if I do a lot of metta practice? Will that help me to let go of thought? So you do a lot of metta practice and then see what's the result. What happens if I'm more strict with myself? You know, if I were just caught, you know, something like that. How would that be? And then you do it. So then doubt is not just sort of living in a kind of strange state, because no one can answer these things for us. You can only answer yourself. So self-doubt, not being sure of yourself, like you get, if you have a very, very intellectual bent, you'll find people who really have a highly developed intellect will, you know, always be reading. And then, I don't know about this. And then they'll get another answer. I don't know about this. So their mind will always be caught up in discursive thought. And there's a kind of neat satisfaction in that, I'm getting an answer. Yeah, I got that now. I know that one. But then the mind falls into doubt again. And look up the books. Ask someone up. And it's okay to have conclusions and so on, but if that's a pattern, doubt answer, then the mind's never going to really be peaceful, because it'll always be attached to thought. Always attached. So again, I often spoke about this, like in Korean Zen, they use the don't know mind. It sounds like gobbledygook, doesn't it? Just don't know mind. Don't know. And yet there's the knowing. There's just this, like if you just like listen to this moment, there's no answer to it, but there's knowing, there's clarity, there's presence. So how to use intellect skillfully And when does it just become a burden, constantly filling your mind with information, with ideas, and then never really getting beyond doubt? In terms of like the concepts that one uses in Buddhism, you don't need that much, but you need to go deeply. And that's why I think Ajahn Sumedho's constant reference to the Four Noble Truths is just, he's really gone deep into that. And, you know, I found his teaching quite elegant in simplicity and depth. It's really beautiful because he's really taken something very, very deeply. So there's breadth, you know, getting a lot of information and it's an encyclopedic kind of knowledge, but there's also depth, taking like a few ideas and becoming more and more profoundly understanding of it.